to me, it makes a difference. You know, it's door by door and voter by voter.
In the final days of the campaign for Alaska's lone seat in the U.S. House, activists canvassed neighborhoods in Anchorage on behalf of their candidates. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 1st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, how would the Stand for Salmon ballot measure affect everyday Alaskans?
You know, I've been involved in a lot of rulemakings over the years. This one's going to be as hard as anything I've ever seen, just because there's so much interest in it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Bristol Bay Subsistence Regional Advisory Council will discuss proposals to change federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations and other subsistence-related issues, and invites public participation at a meeting November 6th, starting at 8:30 a.m. at the Dillingham Middle School Gym. More at 800-478-1456 or doi.gov/subsistence/regions. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Pollster Ivan Moore released survey results today showing Congressman Don Young is running slightly behind first-time candidate Elise Galvin. Galvin has raised more money than the incumbent, but Young hasn't lost a race in 45 years, and pollsters have underestimated him before. Even some of Galvin's supporters are keeping their hopes in check. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports on how the two campaigns are selling their candidates in the final days of the race.
Sarah Dykstra is good at getting strangers to open their door. But on an icy night in Fairview, one undecided voter would only peek out the window. Dykstra held up her Elise Galvin campaign literature.
She's running for Congress against Don Young. She said, I'll talk to you.
It probably helps Dykstra's success rate that she often brings her toddler. And she's hugely pregnant. She's due to deliver next week, right after Election Day.
Hi. Okay. So have you heard of Elise Galvin running for Congress?
Yes.
You have?
I didn't know who that was, but then when you said against Don Young, then yes.
Okay, so you are not voting for Don Young is your plan?
Well, pretty much.
That's great. I'm not either. So.
Dykstra ran through Galvin's attributes. She's a lifelong Alaskan, an independent, and the Democratic nominee. Dykstra told her Galvin wants everyone to have affordable health care.
Yeah, but who pays for it?
Who pays for it? Well, I'll tell you right now, we all are paying really astronomical rates for health care as it is.
Dykstra
right?
kept the woman talking for 5 minutes.
Those are the interesting ones, I think, when you can actually engage them in a conversation. And, you know, I think, to me, it makes a difference. You know, it's door by door and voter by voter.
At her threadbare campaign headquarters in Spinard, people are working even in the garage. But retired electrician Bill Sosnowski has the laundry alcove all to himself. He asks an undecided voter in Tok if he'll support Galvin to unseat Young.
Right now you don't think so? All right, so no matter what you do or what you say, you don't think he's going to leave, right?
That's part of the challenge for Galvin supporters, fighting the sense that Young's re-election is inevitable. Those who don't like Young have had their hopes dashed 23 times before.
Well, you know, you could be that person that helps him retire.
Don wins the battles. Alaska can't afford to lose.
I'm Don Young, and I approve this message.
Young is in heavy rotation on TV, and his ads are on the back of public buses in Anchorage. But Young's ground game is less visible than Galvin's. His campaign repeatedly told me there were no events I could attend this week with Young or his volunteers. Young's longtime campaign manager, Jerry Hood, says they're busy getting out the vote. And what kind of get out the vote stuff is going on?
Phone banking, and just working all the angles to make sure that people vote.
But a week before the election, while Galvin headquarters was abuzz in the evening, Young's campaign office was dark during prime calling hours, and the parking area was empty. I asked Hood if Young's phone banking was taking place somewhere else.
It'll happen at the campaign office when it occurs.
Hood says he thinks when Alaskans get in the voting booths on Tuesday, they'll again mark the oval next to Young's name. And Hood points out the congressman is still getting bills signed into law.
And I think Alaskans know that, and they won't jeopardize their future by electing a naive rookie with no experience.
Political science research shows persuasion campaigns aren't all that effective, not if they run counter to a voter's partisan lean. But urging your supporters to the polls, that works. And as Galvin supporters see it, the 24th time could be the charm. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
One of the major issues separating the leading candidates to become governor is education. How they approach the issue may also reflect their leadership styles. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
Democrat Mark Begich and Republican Mike Donlavey come from different backgrounds. Begich has been outside the education system, relying on experts to shape his approach to the issue. His central educational proposal is a plan to put half of the state draw from permanent fund earnings into schools. The other half would pay out permanent fund dividends. He said at a recent debate that this would prevent school funding from being on the chopping block every year.
We need to protect it. It's the greatest equalizer for everyone in this state if we make sure it's funded properly and protected for generations to come.
Donlavey's perspective comes from working within the system as a teacher, school administrator, and school board member. Along the way, he's built up strong views on how education should be delivered. Donlavey also laid out his plans during recent debates. He wants to require that all third graders read at grade level, all ninth graders learn algebra, and all career and technical students reach higher standards.
We have to reallocate resources to make sure that we're focused on those three core areas. If we do that, you're going to see our scores go up, and you're going to see kids have more of an opportunity.
Donlavey supports allowing more rural students to attend regional high schools. He says he wants to expand students' options and doesn't want to close schools in villages.
It's to enhance, not to take away.
It's not clear how he would pay for both, while also cutting the state budget overall. When he chaired the Senate subcommittee that proposes education funding, he supported eliminating all state funding for pre-kindergarten. He also backed cuts to other state funding for programs that prepare young children for school, such as Head Start. In contrast, Begich wants to provide universal pre-kindergarten.
There's no question early education is the best investment we can make.
Donlavey has also supported a constitutional amendment to allow public money to go to private or religious education, though he says he wouldn't push the amendment now. When he was on the Matanuska-Susitna School Board, Donlavey supported expanding support for homeschooling. He hasn't focused on that in his campaign for governor. Begich opposes vouchers, saying that public education is a foundation for communities and the economy. Kenny Gallahorn has known Donlavey for more than 20 years, since Donlavey started teaching in Kotzebue schools. Gallahorn's a former member of both the Kotzebue and state school boards. He's a big supporter of regional schools. Gallahorn says he trusts Donlavey more than Begich on handling rural education issues.
As a state, we pump a lot of money into education, and we're not getting very much bang for our buck, honestly. The results, as shown by our test results and many other indicators, actually are not well.
Others who've worked with Donlavey have a different impression. Susan Crane was the local teachers union president when Donlavey was superintendent for the Northwest Arctic schools. She says he had a top-down leadership style and predicts that will cause problems when dealing with the legislature.
When I first realized that he was actually running for governor, I was thinking if he's anything like he was as a principal or even when he was working over at district office and working with teachers, I was thinking he's not going to listen to the people. He's going to have his own way of doing things, and he's going to try to control decisions based on what he wants rather than what the people want.
Bethany Markham disagrees with Crane's assessment of Donlavey. She worked with him on education issues as a legislative aide and says he treated his staff with respect.
We had a team structure whereby we all had open access to him. We were able to engage with him at any given time of day.
Begich's career hasn't had the same focus on education as Donlavey's, but he's still impressed some who've worked with him. Carol Como worked with Begich as superintendent of Anchorage Schools when Begich was the city's mayor. She says Begich was a leader on education issues, even when it wasn't a central responsibility for him as mayor.
When he'd go to Juneau to lobby for the city of Anchorage, he also was very much willing to support our requests and our needs.
So sharp differences on public schools separate the two leading candidates who will be on the ballot on Tuesday. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Alaskans will soon cast votes on Ballot Measure 1, the controversial initiative aimed at protecting Alaska's salmon habitat. Companies behind big proposed mines and oil developments have helped raise millions to campaign against the initiative. Opponents say Ballot Measure 1 could hinder projects like road improvements, but supporters say it was specifically designed to easily allow vital infrastructure to be built. So how will the ballot measure affect mid-sized projects used by everyday Alaskans? As Elizabeth Harbaugh with Alaska's Energy Desk reports, the answer isn't clear-cut.
Part of the uncertainty on how the Salmon Habitat Initiative could affect things like small-scale hydro projects or mom-and-pop placer mines hinges on a single phrase in the ballot measure: significant adverse effects. That's because if it passes, projects that could cause significant adverse effects to salmon habitat will go through a much tougher and more public vetting process to get what's called a major permit. So what counts as a significant adverse effect on salmon? And where's the line between a major permit and a minor permit?
We have not made an actual determination about that yet.
That's Ron Bankert, a regional supervisor with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the agency that would carry out the ballot measure. Bankert says the measure does lay out some clear definitions, like if a project blocks fish from passing through, that's significant. Other criteria on what counts as significant are less clear, he says.
Some of them are kind of difficult to define, and it would probably require us to develop some additional regulations to further clarify that.
So if the measure passes, that's not the end of the story. Although it will go into effect 90 days after the election results are final, the state will probably end up writing regulations. And those regulations would try to nail down the distinction between projects in salmon habitat that have to clear a higher bar and projects that won't. Eric Felstead is an attorney with Perkins Coie, a firm that has worked for companies opposing the ballot measure and the campaign against it. Felstead says if the salmon habitat measure passes, Fish and Game will be under intense scrutiny as it goes about figuring out what counts as significant adverse effects on fish habitat.
You know, I've been involved in a lot of rulemakings over the years. This one's going to be as hard as anything I've ever seen just because there's so much interest in it.
Little projects like boat ramps, the state can probably safely put projects like that under the minor category. And a big proposed mine that will displace salmon streams? That'll definitely go through the tougher permitting process. But Felstead says there's some gray area in the middle, and he thinks that will be tricky for Fish and Game to navigate.
You know, you have, say, a road that's 75 yards long with a gravel pad where you want to build a cabin, and it's through kind of a swampy area that is deemed to be anadromous fish habitat. You know, is that going to be under the minor scheme? I think those are the questions that are harder, that are kind of right on the line.
Emily Anderson, an attorney with the Wild Salmon Center who helped write the initiative, pushed back on opponents who say needed infrastructure projects will be hindered by the ballot measure. She says she trusts Fish and Game to not write overly burdensome regulations.
It's really, really premature to say you'll never be able to do this or expand your airport in X, Y, and Z community. That's ridiculous to say that at this point.
Anderson acknowledges it's hard to pinpoint exactly what projects will get a minor permit and what projects will go through the tougher vetting process. But she adds it's not about how big or small a project is or what kind of project it is. The measure was written so it's all about how much it affects salmon habitat.
You can have a very large project that has very little impact to fish habitat and therefore can be processed as a minor permit. You can have a very small project that the way it's being proposed can have very high impacts to fish habitat and that may be proposed as a major project.
So a project's size may not be the best indicator of how much it could be impacted by Ballot Measure 1. And even then, when it comes to how the initiative could impact some projects used by everyday Alaskans, a lot rides on how the state writes the regulations to implement it. But before all that, this coming Tuesday, Alaskans will vote to decide whether the ballot measure should go forward at all. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage honors political trailblazer Betty Davis.
Senator Davis actually has done more than a lot of individuals put together.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska.
A report shows fewer babies were born and fewer people got married in the state last year. The Alaska Vital Statistics Report for 2017 shows about 10,400 babies were delivered last year, a decrease from the more than 11,200 births recorded in 2016. The state recorded more than 5,100 marriages and nearly 2,700 separations last year. That's a decrease in both categories from 2016. The only regular flight between Alaska and Russia has been suspended after Russian authorities revoked the airline's license to fly abroad. Russia-based Yakutia Airlines had offered weekly service between Anchorage and Russia's Kamchatka Peninsula during the summer months. But this week, Russia's aviation authorities sanctioned the airline for failure to properly maintain its Boeing 737 jets. Yakutia Airlines and others have struggled to make a profit off scheduled flights between Alaska and Russia's Far East. In 2013, a leased Boeing 737 was grounded in Anchorage for weeks over unpaid bills. Former lawmaker Betty Davis retired from the Anchorage School Board in September after more than 35 years in public service. On the board and in the state legislature, Davis fought for education reform and helped break barriers for Black Alaskans and women in government. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, the school board invited the community to a celebration commemorating her career.
Generally, school board meetings are filled with educators and parents waiting to testify before the board about a myriad of issues. But the most recent meeting was filled with the sounds of drumming. The Clark Middle School drumline kicked off a tribute to Betty Davis. After the performance, the Clark Informers, a school group dedicated to sharing history, told Davis's story to the crowd.
Mrs. Davis has been a resident of Anchorage for more than 40 years. She arrived here with her
husband. Davis was elected to the Anchorage School Board in 1982. She already had a career as a social worker before she retired in 1986. She then moved on to a second career in politics. Celeste Hodge Groudon helped organize the tribute.
We are really fortunate to have someone like Senator Davis, who actually has done more than a lot of individuals put together.
Davis served three different terms on the board. She advocated for pre-K funding, reducing dropout rates, and equity for Anchorage students. During the tribute, current board president Star Marcette credited Davis with helping getting her elected.
When we were both running at the same time, we put out a flyer that we put both our faces on. And I know that they probably voted because I was next to Betty Davis. And so I just always appreciate her support and all the wisdom that she's given me over the years.
When Davis was elected to the State House of Representatives in 1990, she became the first elected Black woman to serve in the legislature. Davis would end up going on to become the first Black Alaskan to serve in the Alaska Senate when she was elected in 2000. While in the legislature, Davis's passion for education remained at the forefront. She was given the nickname Conscience of the Legislature and championed legislation for education, social issues, and economic development. Stephanie Berglund is the CEO of Thread, a nonprofit that focuses on providing affordable early childcare to Alaska families.
Betty Davis was very instrumental in supporting increases to education funding, of course, an advocate to ensure that funding wasn't cut, and championed an effort specifically around funding for early childhood teachers and strengthening the early childhood workforce.
After losing re-election in 2013, Davis returned to the school board for her third term. She served until mid-September, when she resigned for medical reasons. She was too sick to attend the celebration. The board appointed a white man, Mark Foster, to fill Davis's seat. Celeste Hodge Groudon criticized the board directly for not choosing a diverse replacement for Davis, despite many applicants of color.
I understand Saturday, the Anchorage School Board missed an opportunity.
Hodge Groudon points out that every member currently on the Anchorage School Board is white.
To have some diversity on the board so that our students, which is largely minority now within the Anchorage School District, could actually identify with somebody that looks like them.
Davis's son, Tony Davis, was at the celebration on his mother's behalf and echoed that sentiment. He says his mother was a role model for many students in the district. Tony wouldn't go into specifics of his mother's illness, but he says his mother is aware of the trails that she blazed while serving in office.
She hopes that somebody will step up after she's done and step up and continue the fight.
At the end of the celebration, the Anchorage School Board adopted a resolution formally commemorating Davis's public service legacy in Alaska. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Do you need health insurance but think you can't afford it? Well, did you know that Alaska's individual market health insurance premiums are going down again for 2019? If you need insurance or currently have insurance through the individual market, be sure to shop at healthcare.gov between November 1st and December 15th to confirm that you have the plan that best meets your family's budget and coverage needs. You may also call 1-844-PLANS-AK for local help. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
Four tribes are asking the Bristol Bay Area Health Corporation to hold a full board of directors meeting to address serious deficiencies in the Kanakanak Hospital Pharmacy, as described in a recent survey by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
The Chogyang Tribal Council received a copy earlier this week of the survey, which CMS conducted in September. According to CMS, chronic errors in the Kanakanak Hospital Pharmacy are placing patients at immediate risk of harm and death. Chogyang's concerns about the hospital, however, reach far beyond the pharmacy. Courtney Carty is the tribal administrator.
Although this report is directed at pharmaceutical concerns and addressing mismanagement happening within pharmacy practices at the health corporation, it also outlines concerns regarding the governance structure and lack of response from the administration, as well as what appear to be significant human resource related issues regarding a fear of retaliation for employees reporting safety concerns.
The tribe is calling for changes in hospital leadership, although they have not said specifically what adjustments they hope to see.
I think it's pretty clear to our council that some significant changes need to happen in the administration, as well as the executive committee and governance structure of the health corps organization.
Chogyung said Bristol Bay tribes are not the only ones who want to see change. It said it received a memo from the Kanakanak Hospital medical staff that addressed the CMS survey and called for changes in the top level of hospital administration. The memo was sent to the full BBAHC board. In addition to requesting a full BBAHC board meeting, the Chogyang Tribal Council is exploring other options for healthcare.
Because we authorize this tribal health organization to provide services on our behalf, at any time we're able to explore our options to rescind that authorization. And that is something the Tribal Council is discussing and trying to work towards a solution on at this time.
Portage Creek Village Council, the Traditional Council of Togiak, and the new Stuyahok Traditional Council are also asking BBAHC to hold a full board meeting in response to the CMS survey. The Togiak Traditional Council declined to comment on the survey findings. However, it said it fully supports the hospital's medical staff and their call for change in hospital leadership. Wassily Gust is the president of the new Stuyahok Traditional Council. He said the council is in support of a full board meeting, which he believes is vital to solving problems in the pharmacy. He said he also has concern about BBAHC and hospital leadership.
I believe that the executive committee and CEO need re-evaluation. An evaluation. Been sitting stagnant too long. Not that I have anything against the CEO, it's just that they need to look down and refocus on where health issue needs to go.
Gust added that as a patient at the hospital, he requested a refill over a month ago of a medication that he takes daily. He said he's been out of medication for weeks and that the pharmacy is not responding to his calls.
Well, I'm out of meds until someone delivers them. I'm beginning to think everybody's gone to the dog team days.
Kinnekonek Hospital must provide CMS with a corrective action plan for the deficiencies found in the survey by November 7th. The hospital declined to comment for this story. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
One of the largest old-growth timber harvests in years has been proposed on Prince of Wales Island. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, the U.S. Forest Service says logging would help fuel the local economy.
The Forest Service's project manager, Delilah Brigham in Thorne Bay, said at first blush, this project does look big, but
we're looking at metering out timber harvest over 15 years. So yes, the project does offer a larger amount of old growth, but it's not going to be harvested all right now within 1 year.
The proposal envisions as much as 225 million board feet of old growth timber logged. That would dwarf the recent Big Thorn project, which was touted as offering nearly 150 million board feet of timber. And unlike Big Thorn, this proposal doesn't immediately identify specific areas to be logged. Rather, it covers a patchwork of Tongass National Forest lands on Prince of Wales and surrounding islands. But Brigham said the purpose remains the same, feed demand.
We had a wide variety of comments from different size mills across the project area, saying that they're businesses rely on a steady supply of timber.
That's been met with skepticism. Pat Lavin is an Anchorage-based representative of Defenders of Wildlife, a national environmental group opposing the plan.
There's no evidence that anything would be milled locally, and that at least hasn't been the trend and isn't what one would expect out of this sale either. Most of the product has been exported, unfortunately, and that would probably continue.
The Forest Service also received pushback over concerns about commercial logging's effects on fish and wildlife habitat.
Prince of Wales Island has been the site of some of the most intense logging over the past several decades.
Austin Williams is with the Alaska chapter of Trout Unlimited.
The thrust of our comments were to encourage the Forest Service to really be mindful of impacts to fish and wildlife and to really find a way to move the timber program more towards young growth and away from this old growth logging.
The Forest Service had considered other alternatives. Tongass Forest Supervisor Earl Stewart is the official who signed off on this most aggressive logging plan. He's unfazed by criticism, saying controversy is part of the process.
You know, managing of competing interests from all the different programs and elements is always a challenge and always difficult.
The Forest Service will publish its draft decision on Saturday. That triggers a 45-day window for people to raise objections. The agency then reviews those comments before releasing its final decision. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Ammon Swenson. Wesley Early is our producer. And I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.